Please silence all electronic devices.
Members, the nurse of the day today is...
The job we have as legislators is to decide where the lines are.
It is a very sacred and holy institution.
I'll move to amend the bill.
Even the old folks in Devon knew.
He said, hey, ain't you Jesse Harrell? And I couldn't deny that. I said, yeah.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
While I do not believe I did anything illegal or ever thought I was doing anything illegal...
You're fired!
North Carolina General Assembly enacted.
Any further discussion or debate?
This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Backroom budget negotiations are in full swing in the General Assembly. We know a little bit more about who will be representing North Carolina in Congress. And the presidential campaign is already reaching its tentacles into North Carolina. I'm Dave DeWitt, Managing Editor for News here at WUNC, and I'm here with Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief.
Great to be here.
Jorge Valencia, Capitol Bureau Reporter.
Hey, Dave.
And let's start in Raleigh at the General Assembly. As we're talking today, this is Thursday, pardon me, getting my days wrong already, Senate and House budget leaders are, we think, working on a budget behind closed doors. Jorge, what's happening? What are you hearing over there, and where are they sort of in this process?
Okay, so the House officially declined to accept the Senate's version of the budget. That happened this week. And what we would have at this point, because the Senate approved their version so recently, right now probably the House leadership in the House is reviewing the Senate version, and they probably haven't started sitting down with the leadership, their counterparts in the Senate. I think that what's perhaps a little bit more interesting right now that's happening behind closed doors is this measure with coal ash, because we were expecting that the General Assembly was going to override the governor's veto on this controversial coal ash measure. As you know, this measure, the point of contention here is that the governor says that the General Assembly keeps too much oversight over this commission that oversees the cleanup of the coal ash ponds. They've already gone to court over it. The governor already won. The General Assembly came back with this version that they say complies with what the Supreme Court said. And what we thought was that we would get quickly an override because almost every single member of the Senate voted for this bill. A strong bipartisan majority in the House voted for it. But the Senate is just kind of sitting on it. Now, I went and I looked for the rules chair in the Senate, Tom Apodaca, and I asked him about it yesterday. And he's usually a pretty loquacious guy, and he just said, I don't know, we're going to vote on this soon. One of our counterparts, Mark Binker from WRAL, was doorstepping Senate Leader Phil Berger's office, and he spoke with the CEO from Duke Energy, which owns these ponds, right after she walked out of his office. And swiftly, she just said, no comment.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we've got Chuck McGrady, who is sort of the lead person behind this. He's a Republican in the House. He's the lead person behind it in the House chamber. He said that he heard that the Senate leadership was trying to negotiate some kind of deal with the governor over this, but that he's not a part of it. So it's possible that maybe there is some sort of aversion in the General Assembly suddenly over what would probably be a second lawsuit if the General Assembly chose to override this veto. So we got a little bit of unclear behind the scenes drama going on.
It's so interesting with the coal ash thing, the politics of it all, because it behooves all the Republicans in the General Assembly and Governor McCrory, to everybody to be on the same page with it, because it's going to be a campaign issue, going to be brought up by Democrats in local races and statewide races. But, you know, they can't seem to get behind one idea or how things should be going.
Right, but they're not running the same races, right?
Yeah.
I mean, for Senator Berger to be reelected, or Tim Moore, or Legislator X from County Y, their constituency looks much different than the governor's.
Mm-hmm. Because the governor has to run everybody in the state.
Right, get enough support statewide in order to win. So I think that is one minor point in this whole thing. And the other effort that, you know, we've seen out of Governor McCrory as it pertains to this, some of this is about power. So some of this whole battle is about, you know, who gets to make appointments, about who's going to make the rules, about who's going to clean up coal ash and how they're going to do it. And then there's also this piece with McCrory of distancing himself from Duke. Duke is in favor of what the legislature is doing presently, right? I think.
They're supportive of the measure that
the governor is not in favor of that. So this is political cover for him to come out in September or October and say, hey, I was tough on.
Right.
I was tough on.
Yeah. And they're both running for that sort of environmental protection high ground, you know, which is really interesting, right? Because a lot of the environmental groups are then saying...
One could say ironic along with interesting.
Right. And so the environmental groups in varying stages and in varying levels of vitriol are saying that we like this or don't like this. And it's not unanimous on that side either. So there's a lot of... And, behind the scenes activity.
And I think that there's there's a lot of distrust from the General Assembly on what the on what the governor will do and his Department of Environmental Quality,
right,
which oversees. And they're competing over, we are bringing the toughest measures. The General Assembly is saying we will be the most strict. The governor says, no, I'm going to be the most strict. It's unclear.
Right. Battle of power, battle of perception.
And even the governmental agencies, DEQ and the Department of Health and Human Services, can't really get on the same page about whether, you know, these are in the water and how bad they are and all of those things. So it's definitely worth watching. A lot of interesting moving parts.
As for the budget, though, you asked about the budget.
Uh-huh.
The two chambers are closer now than they were last August when they went into this similar conference committee. So my hunch would be not next week. Maybe the following week, definitely the week of the, what would that be, the 26th.
Right.
If we don't get it the week of the 19th, I think we get the week of the 26th. One would expect, maybe this is optimistic and maybe I'm not jaded and cynical enough, but they're going to have a budget by July 1st, right?
Well, that's what they've been saying.
Right,
I mean,
right.
The thing is that, you know, the schedule in a General Assembly like ours is very fluid because we don't have a set adjournment date the way that other states do. So they do want to get out by the 4th of July, but it's unclear. I mean, you're right. I mean, I think it seems like we could get there. There's a lot of activity at the General Assembly this week, a lot of bills running through committees, a lot of press conferences. It seems like perhaps lawmakers are trying to get things done because they want to get out
sure.
there quickly. Quick reminder, what's at stake here? I think the biggest points of contention here are our plans to lower income taxes and if and how and who will get pay raises,
right.
primarily public school teachers and state employees.
Right. And it is worth noting they can pass a budget and continue to legislate for a couple of weeks. We could get a budget on June 28th and they could adjourn July 15th.
They could, but
they
doubt they'll go that much longer. Once they pass a budget,
right.
I think they'll be wanting a piece
right.
out of there.
But it could go AB, right? Like budget could come first, as we saw last year.
Right. It's a hard place to predict, but it seems
right.
that they're further along than they were in recent years.
Yeah,
along
absolutely.
With the budget
yeah.
anyway.
I mean, yeah.
Well, let's change gears a little bit to the congressional primary that happened just earlier this week. A lot of interesting races sort of going in that were over really quickly once the results started coming in. For example, Jeff, you heard from your sources that internal polling had George Holding way ahead of Renee Elmers. I remember talking about that and going,
not
by 30 points.
But
it turned out it was
heard.
Exactly right.
It was on point.
It was on point.
Wow. It was on point.
That race was over early. Did that surprise you?
It didn't surprise me that Holding won. It didn't surprise me that he won comfortably. I was surprised that he won by 30 points.
Yeah.
And maybe the final number was 27 or 28. I don't remember exactly what it was. But I think it was right at 30. And it was also interesting that Renee Elmers, a sitting member of Congress, I mean, she was almost had fewer votes than Brannon
right.
In this race. So that was surprising. This is a weird race in that it was incumbents facing off. We had this redistricting happen at the late in the game as the federal courts ruled, a federal panel of judges ruled that two of the North Carolina congressional boundaries, present boundaries, are illegal racial gerrymanders. So they redrew them, and the new second looks more like Holding's current district than Renee Elmer's current district. Anyway, he's the incumbent in the 13th, and he attacked her from the word go. As these new maps were drawn, he decided to get into this race.
Very quickly,
that she
yeah.
wasn't as conservative as she purported to be. And, he smothered her.
He was on the attack. She was on the defensive.
Right.
In a race like
right.
this with so few people voting,
right.
that seemed to make a difference.
And a candidate like him, I mean, he'd been in Congress longer than Renee Elmers had been. It seemed like...
She was there one term longer than him. This was
really?
Her third, his second. Yeah, she
no
first
kidding.
Went in 2010. Huh. He went in 2012.
Okay, well, thanks. I stand corrected.
No, I mean, minor point. it's also interesting to note that when she did get first elected in 2010, it was on the back of Koch brother money, on Americans for Prosperity money, Tea Party money. So that's what helped her get into Congress. She was a nurse.
Now,
she was an outsider. But now...
The Koch brothers
right.
put money to unseat her.
First time, I believe, ever that the Koch brothers have spent money to oust a sitting Republican in Congress. Now, that's a little weird because it was incumbent versus incumbent, but they targeted this race and they went after her. And judging by the final outcome, I don't even know if they needed to do it.
Right. Interesting.
So that was the second. I mean, a couple of other interesting ones. Jorge, you spent some time in the 13th, which was a crowded field.
And that one, there was also some outside spending, and which still makes me kind of wonder, I mean, what is the rationale that some of these outside groups out of state use to fund races? So in the 13th district, which was also one that was completely reconfigured because of redistricting, there was no incumbent running because George Holding was running for the second district.
Right, right.
This is sort of a triangular-ish ink blot in the middle of the state between the Triad and Charlotte, roughly.
Burlington to Boone, where App State is
down to
Mecklenburg County.
And we had 22 people running, 17 of them Republicans, mostly Republicans because this is a district that was drawn to favor Republicans. We had four members of the General Assembly running, some county commissioners running. We had a radio personality running and some business owners who had never held elected office. And the guy who won has a really great – I think he's a great political name – Ted Budd. And Ted Budd owns a gun shop. He is part owner of a farm, and he had never run for elected office. And so he had this he raised a lot of money, about $130,000 on his own. But then there was this outside group from Washington that injected $500,000, almost $500,000 into this race, running ads that were really just touting him as this like great outsider and really promoting the fact that this guy has never run for political office before. And that's why it sort of like raises the question for me. It's something that I haven't been able to figure out yet, which is how do they figure out who they want to spend money on? Because he doesn't have a political record. How do they know that he's going to do what it is that they want him to do?
Probably for that reason, right? I mean, at least not necessarily that he would do this. I'm not insinuating that.
Of course not.
He's a clean slate, right? He has ideas, I'm sure he does. I'm sure he has things that he believes in. But he's not super savvy politically because he hasn't been doing it for many years. And so maybe he can be influenced. Maybe that's their thinking.
I would imagine there were some one-on-one or some small group conversations behind closed doors where they hashed out some possible legislation that they would hope to.
I remember when Renee Elmers ran. That was the thinking with her, and that's been a thinking with Democrats throughout
the
years.
Because she was also
a
first-time candidate,
because they're brand new. They haven't been corrupted, so to speak, through the process. But
let's note with Ted Budd. He got, I'm not looking at the
total. He got 20% of the vote.
But total?
He won with 6,300 votes. That is how many people elected Ted Budd, who was favored to win in November.
And the population of that district is roughly
700,000.
So
6,000. A percent? Less than a percent.
Less than 1%.
Less than a percent.
Of the population.
This is, so 20% of the vote.
And he'll be one of 435 members of Congress. He had less than 7,000 votes.
Right.
That's,
I mean,
that's,
I think that probably the graduating class at UNC Chapel Hill.
Oh, it's twice
probably,
that. Maybe, right? Well, maybe not the
was
class.
Maybe
right.
Like around that size.
Right.
So yeah, I mean that was a really interesting race. That was a case in which like name recognition could have done a lot for you,
but it didn't.
So for the members of the General Assembly, it could have done a lot for them, and it sort of did. I mean, we had two General Assembly members who got 10% of the vote, so they got half as much as Ted Budd did. Maybe they could have one of them could have defeated him in a runoff. Because he didn't get 40% of the vote. He did win comfortably, but not 40% of the vote.
Mm. Right.
Which meant that under rules outside of this race, you wouldn't need a runoff.
Right.
But he didn't need that.
Four state lawmakers in this race. Let's make the point. When you throw 17 candidates onto the table, who knows how the vote's going to fracture? I mean, the establishment people, so to speak, probably hurt each other to some extent. If there's only one state legislator in that race, they probably have a better chance of beating Ted Budd as opposed to dealing with three other state legislators and Ted Budd.
Right.
I mean, just a thought.
I've never spoken to Ted Budd, but I would bet a year ago he never dreamed that he was going to be a member of Congress.
No
Probably
way.
Probably not.
Right,
no,
because of the way that everything broke out,
exactly.
Brand new district. Suddenly he can get in this race.
Right.
He saw his opportunity.
Yeah.
He did things well, obviously. He was able to sort of stick out from a large group of people. But a year ago, can you think Ted Budd was sitting in his
really
living
good
room
opportunity.
Going, you know, I'm going to go to see if I can get in Congress.
It was a bunch of things that worked out in his favor, like you said. Brand new district. He's right in the middle of it. Very conservative district. There's no incumbent because George Holding is, you know, duking out with Renee Elmers, meanwhile. And then we've also got this wave of outsiders who are coming in. Started with the Tea Party in 2010. Then we've got the new Republican presidential presumptive nominee who really wears as a badge of honor the fact that he's never held elected office, but he's this businessman, so he can do great things for the country. And Ted Budd, similarly, no political experience, successful businessman.
Yep.
2 years from now, which one of us is most likely to make a run at Congress?
I don't think so. Maybe president of the press corps at the North Carolina General Assembly building.
It won't be me.
That's the highest office.
I don't like people. But maybe one of you too. Well, let's move on to the presidential election because I'm pretty fascinated by it in general. But sort of as a segue, Donald Trump supported one race for Congress in the last couple of months. It was Renee Elmers, mm-hmm. right? And she was defeated soundly.
In fairness, he jumped in late.
He jumped in late, right? But he did. It was, you know, there was a pretty positive endorsement.
Right.
It was maybe Renee Elmer's Hail Mary pass because maybe she could see some of the writing on the wall. But she was one of the first people in Congress to support him.
Right.
So what does that say, if anything, about what's going to happen here in the presidential race? Keep in mind that the Hillary Clinton campaign has opened their office in North Carolina. Donald Trump has been here twice, I think, and he's going to be coming more frequently, and as is probably Hillary Clinton and whatever vice presidential candidates they choose. How does this change anything? The Elmers, is Trump going to win? How is this going to work out?
I don't think Trump's endorsement of Elmers changes anything or significantly alters my opinions of anything. I think, at least for me individually, it reiterates and strengthens this point of there is chaos. This is chaos. There is so much unknown. And every political scientist and strategist and pundit and expert who says, well, he's done, or this is going to happen, or we don't know what's going to happen.
Nobody knows anything.
Nobody knows. And that's interesting and exciting. And I think for a lot of people, scary. Mm-hmm. And people on the right and people on the left.
Right.
But I think I've said this before on the podcast, maybe I've said it on the State of Things. One thing I'm interested in seeing more of, history tells us that polling numbers from election years in May and June aren't reliable, right. aren't very good. So not interested
entire
in seeing
lifetime
polls at this point.
From now until
right.
November.
I am interested in seeing public polling policy, whatever their PPP is, released something yesterday or the day before on likely voters in the general in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Just add another P to it. I'm interested in that as we get closer. I want to know about – and they had it tied between Trump and Clinton with Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate,
right.
polling at 6% in Pennsylvania, which strikes me as pretty darn high. I don't think a Libertarian is going to carry 6% of the vote in the state.
Is
but maybe he will.
Is he from Pennsylvania, though?
He's not. He's former governor of New Mexico.
Okay.
And he was a Republican governor of New Mexico, very popular there. He's an interesting character in and of himself. But in this poll, the Libertarian Gary Johnson was holding 6% of the vote, and Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, was holding 3% of the vote, which I'm not a pollster, but that strikes me as high. Anyway, my point is this. I am interested in seeing more data from these swing states.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care about Mississippi and California and my home state of Massachusetts. We know what those states are going to do. North Carolina is one.
Yep.
So to answer your question, it's chaos.
Right.
And it's going to be really interesting
point
in these half dozen states.
In that poll you're talking about, the public policy polling, Trump.
Thank you.
Trump was defeated soundly in a one-on-one race with?
Bernie Sanders.
No, the Philly Fanatic.
Oh, God.
That they polled the Philly Fanatic versus Trump, and more people voted.
Wait,
for Philly.
I'm sorry.
Bernie
what's
Sanders.
The Philly Fanatic? I'm
it
sorry.
Is the mascot of the Philadelphia Phillies,
the Major League Baseball team.
Was that a joke?
Yeah. Well, PPP always throws that in there.
Yeah.
They always throw that in there. They throw one of those little sort of joke things.
So they
can
be throwing like Hulk Hogan.
And no, they do that, and it works every time they get on the late night shows because of that. And good for them, by the way. But
you had
a point.
Well, the poll did also show that Trump would lose to Sanders in Pennsylvania, but obviously that race isn't going to happen unless. An FBI indictment or something.
So just really quick, circle back to how the national campaigns, how are they going to impact North Carolina? I think my take on it right now is that probably our biggest statewide candidates, Pat McCrory, Roy Cooper for governor, I think they're being really cautious right now about how closely they associate themselves with their party's nominee because they know mm-hmm. – they want to be with their party, and they want to get those supporters. But they also realize that these are two highly unpopular candidates. So, for example, the governor this week after a cabinet meeting this week, reporters asked him, "Are you supporting Donald Trump?" And his only answer was yes. No elaboration, just yes. And so reporters are like, "Okay, why?" And he's like, "Well, because I said I was going to support my party's nominee." That's it. And that's all the comment that he had.
Right.
So he wants to say, "Yeah, you know, I'm playing with my party." But I think that and Roy Cooper similarly has not been very enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. So I think that they want to play with their party, but they also want to run their own show and say, "Hey, I'm my own candidate. I'm going to be the governor of North Carolina. I'm doing my own thing. By the way, look at that guy who's in bed with Hillary Clinton."
And this is
or
something
with,
we've seen in North Carolina
with Donald Trump
for decades.
That's
I mean,
right.
as Mike Easley ran for governor in 2000, 2004, he did not closely align himself with Al Gore or with John Kerry, because Democrat in North Carolina tends to be less liberal than Democrat.
Right.
In
That's
the
always
States.
Happened in the Democratic Party. But,
right.
But the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Is new, right?
Because this is new distancing, right?
This distancing is not something that's ever happened before. If George Bush came through or Romney came through, people were lining up to be associated with him. Not everybody, because as the Tea Party movement grew, some of that split apart, but it is new.
Agree, totally. To take it in a different direction or another direction, we'll be interested to see if Burr and McCrory end up going to Cleveland, going to the Republican National Convention, because we've heard from, and the Bushes aren't going. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of establishment Republicans have said, "We're not going." A lot of senators who are, I think Ron Johnson, who's a Republican senator from Wisconsin, one term, seeking kind of a tough challenge, he has said, "I'm not going to Cleveland." Like that doesn't benefit me.
Yeah,
we'll see how close
members
the
General Assembly who are planning on going.
Okay,
yeah, going.
Right.
Yeah.
And you mentioned Richard Burr. I think it's fascinating because he has both said, you know, admonished Trump for certain statements, and then other people have mentioned him as a possible VP candidate with Trump. And so, you know, he's going to have to ride that the same way McCrory is going to have to when they come to the state, Trump and Clinton, and go to their rallies. Typically, you know, the people who speak right before them are other candidates on the ballot. But I don't think we'll see McCrory at a Trump rally. I would be surprised, and I don't know that we'll see Cooper at a Clinton rally.
By the way, I saw on Trump's travel calendar, he's scheduled for Greensboro on Tuesday.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a long, interesting ride here as the presidential race heats up in North Carolina. Well, that does it for the WUNC Politics Podcast this week. Jeff, Jorge, thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Hey, thanks, Dave.
Make sure to subscribe to the WUNC Politics Podcast on iTunes and Google Play and Stitcher, and follow Jeff Tiberi and Jorge Valencia on Twitter as well. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week.